What? I can't believe I'm hearing this. Wait a minute, let me rewind.
Welcome to Wise Words, a podcast of interviews, best practices and insights for entrepreneurship, finance, and technology, brought to you by the IBD Network, home of the Under the Radar Conferences and Dealmaker Forum. For the best of Silicon Valley, go to www.ibdnetwork.com.
Look at me. Look at me. Now listen very closely.
That doesn't look like the next generation of computing to me. It's old technology.
Welcome to Wise Words, a weekly podcast of interviews on entrepreneurship, finance, and technology. I'm your host, Sean Wise.
You're so wise, but like a miniature Buddha covered in hair.
Welcome back. Today on Wise Words, we discuss how to sell your startup for millions. And our guest is definitely an expert on that topic. He sold Xfire, the social network for video games, to Viacom for over $100 million. But that wasn't his first sale. In total, he sold quite a few of the businesses he's been associated, including as a venture capitalist. He sold Direct Hit to Ask Jeeves for over $500 million. I almost think like I need to bring my little pinky finger up to my lips and do a Dr. Evil smile when you're talking to this gentleman. That's how much he sold his companies for. But if that wasn't enough, but his latest gig sees him sitting as a principal in Google's M&A department. We all know Google, that little company that likes to buy other companies. So ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, please join me and welcome Canada's own Mr. David Lally. David, welcome to the show.
Hey, Sean. Good to talk to you.
And how is the weather on the West Coast? Is it a little better than Toronto in the wintertime?
It's a lot better. It's a lot better than New York right now.
Fair enough. Let's start where we always start with on Wise Words. Let's take us through a history. You graduate high school. You decide, I'm going to do something different. Where do you go from there?
My family was all entrepreneurs. I always wanted to do entrepreneurial stuff, and everything in between was a detour. So I detoured to law school, I detoured to business school, I detoured to McKinsey, lots of detours, but all over the way along I was doing entrepreneurial things.
Do you remember the first startup that you're most proud of?
My last startup is the one that I'm most proud of, Xfire. And it wasn't just because of the success that we had. It was the obstacles that we overcame.
Why don't you walk us through those first days at Xfire and tell us what that was like?
I started Xfire with Mike Cassidy, who I had worked with before. And he was actually the CEO of Direct Hit, which is a company you mentioned in the introduction. And we had an idea around a service for competitive gamers, which was much different than what Xfire ended up becoming. And we ended up putting up the initial capital ourselves and trying to get a beta off the ground. And then the next thing you know, we were in front of VCs and we had a term sheet in our hands for $1 million. And we were more or less committed at that point to going. We started off on a completely different plan.
Now, was that different before you went to the VCs, or when did it change?
It changed. The business plan initially was this service to match competitive gamers so that they could play each other in, test of skill for prizes. And we went out with that business. We kind of launched that service. We got the VC money in January, launched the service initially in beta in March. And I think by April, we knew we were in serious trouble. And it took us a good 3 or 4 months to even come up with kind of what we would, kind of go to next. Meanwhile, we're running out of capital. We launched Xfire, which was the new service as a beta, while still running the old service, Ultimate Arena. We got down to 4 weeks of cash, and then we started to turn the corner.
When you started Xfire, what was the date on that?
January of 2003.
So January.
That's when we raised the capital. In March of 2003 is when we launched the service.
When did you make the first change, the big change? Was it less than 12 months, it sounds like?
Yeah, it was. We started developing the new product, X, the gaming service for kind of a more broader set of gamers around September. So 6 months after. less than 6 months after launching the first service.
And just so our listeners can put it all in context, the final sale date of the business would have been when?
Would have been May of 2006.
May of 2006. So it's a long way to have come in 3 years to be selling a business for more than $100 million when you couldn't, or you were worried about almost making payroll.
We're not almost. We were definitely worried about making payroll, and we're constantly trying to keep the team together, frankly, because we were very transparent in terms of where we were at with all the employees.
Now, before everything became good, it must have become bad. Can you share with us an anecdote of when you and your partner looked at each other and said, okay, this could be as bad as it gets?
There were some very kind of passionate discussions about going down to kind of three employees and, lasting out 8 or 9 months versus trying to keep the thing afloat, show a good face to the investors and try and maintain kind of a faster trajectory. And it wasn't obvious at the time which path would work. This was kind of early 2004, and the investors, kind of the whole climate was much different than it is today, and that was pretty hard. My partner, Mike Cassidy, was definitely on the side of full speed ahead, and I was definitely more cautious, and he was 100% right.
Well, it's good that you can admit that. The big decision between a tortoise and a hare is a tough one to make. Sometimes the hare wants to go faster, but you run the risk of the market not taking you up in enough time to save the company, and you know what happens to the tortoise. If he goes too slow and conserves capital, they may not be able to be competitive. Let's go to the other side of the coin now, just for one brief minute, David. When was the moment you turned to your partner and said, hey, I think we're actually okay now, or things are going well, or I just got this letter which said X, Y, and Z, and I feel comfortable for the first time in a long time?
Yeah. It's interesting because the difference between being early and being wrong actually doesn't feel the same. So when you're actually looking for the signs of traction and you're not seeing any, you don't know which one it is. And
you don't know if you're early, too early for the market, or if you're just totally wrong, is what you're saying.
Exactly, because you're just getting no user traction. And once we got to where we were kind of 20 or 30,000 concurrent users always on, which was we probably had about 500,000 registered users, and we were getting to the point where from user experience, we were seeing that as soon as users added one friend, they were basically staying on for good, and we were growing at 2% a week. Then I knew we were a business that wasn't going to go away.
What was the date of that, where you were growing 2% a week?
We were growing 2% a week almost from the beginning, but there were a few spikes that kind of changed it significantly, like to 4% or even higher when we released different features. But I would say about 4 or 5 months in, so probably the summer of 2004.
So what can you tell our listeners who are currently sitting there wondering why they're not being adopted, and they're now worrying, am I early or am I wrong? What comfort can they take, or how do you know which one it is and still have the confidence to go forward, or do you ever really know?
I don't think you know. I think the thing, again, kind of talking about my partner and kind of the things that I've learned from different people that I've worked with, but Mike in particular, just the unbelievable tenacity it takes to be successful. You don't know how many doors or which doors to open. You know that you can't open all of them because you just simply don't have time. And so you have to make the decision to stretch yourself as far as you can and come in every day and have a smile on your face so that the kind of regular kind of the whole team is basically feeling confident, that you're providing them with some direction. And then you hope to get lucky. So it's everything that I've done, we talk about other things, it's always a combination of tenacity and luck. Everything that's kind of worked out has always been some combination. You can't get there without the tenacity, and chances are you're going to look back and say, wow, that was really lucky, and boy, I'm happy that happened.
Well, wise words do say that the harder you work, the luckier you tend to be. And let's talk about the acquisition itself to Viacom. It ended in May 2006. When did that sort of begin? When was your first contacts? How were those contacts initiated? Was it very obvious, or was it more of a subtle relationship building?
We had relationships with MTV dating back a year prior. So they were a big advertiser. That was one of the relationships that we were nurturing early on, just because they were so interested in the demographic of 18 to 34-year-old males. And that's the demographic that we serve so well.
So you were able to nurture that relationship. And when did they stop going from being someone who you buys from you or you sell to someone who could be acquired? Was it a conversation over drinks, or did you go and pitch them? Did they come and pitch you?
We had other bidders, and that's the kind of best way to draw out kind of your customers and turn them into bidders, is having kind of other alternatives. We had other viable alternatives.
Okay. How did those other alternatives get initiated? Did they come to you, or did you go to them?
A little of both. I don't think that I ever, as an entrepreneur, really thought of cold calling companies, like into their corporate development group. I think that in general, I assumed that if I did a good job on the product side, that companies would naturally hear of us, or they would hear about us through some relationship that we were doing, and acquisition would be something they would consider. And now, looking at things from the inside, I realize that it doesn't hurt to just proactively reach out to people in corporate development just to make sure.
Now, take me to that day when you first find out someone wants to buy you. We're talking, I would imagine, the fall of 2005, if you finished up in May. And did you and your partner say, I don't want to be bought right now, or were you ready to get out? You'd put 3 years in. You thought you'd grown to a certain level. What level were you at, by the way? Let's just use a metric like users. Were you at 100,000 users, a million users?
No, by then we were getting to the 4 million mark.
So you had 4 million users, and I don't know if your revenue was ever public, but it was growing at a good clip.
Yeah, I think we said single-digit millions.
So single-digit millions of revenue, and along comes this first buyer. Were you guys ready to get out at that time? Were the VCs who had provided you with the capital snapping at your heels, or what was your mindset?
I think that if it had been a year ago when we were – I think by the time of the fall, we were pretty confident that we could go it alone, and that was obviously kind of – really made us much more independent in terms of our orientation. So we didn't feel beholden to investors, employees, or kind of other kind of stakeholders in the company. We were really at that point just choosing amongst good options. I think the harder decisions are kind of earlier on when you're less confident. Like once we got to 4 million, the users, active users, was very high, and our minutes was minutes per week was extraordinary, and so we at that point felt very much in the driver's seat.
Now, Viacom may have won the bid, but as you mentioned earlier in the conversation, other bidders had come to the table. Just so people have a good understanding, and we don't need to name names since they didn't win, but were they other suppliers? Were they competitors? Where did you find most of the interest coming from?
Yeah, they, in this case, we're in the online video game business, mostly PC games. And so the kind of obvious players in the space, the large portals, the kind of large gaming portals, were all people that we hoped would be interested in us. And we were successful in getting our interest, in getting their interest.
Now, let's zero in. Considering that most of our listeners want to hear best practices, this wasn't your first deal. We're going to talk a little bit more about some of your M&A activities as a venture partner. But first, let's just stay with Xfire. When you went to negotiate the deal and compare, say, apples to apples, what were the key factors other than price that you were considering?
I mean, most of the manager, everybody else on the team pretty much is working for Viacom right now. So I think that a huge consideration was how appealing that was and whether Viacom was the right place. And I think in this case, we could say, given the leverage that they have from their MTV advertising business, the number of gaming properties they're bringing under one roof, the strategic purpose that they have and intent around this demographic, it felt like it was going to be a good home, a place where the business would continue to thrive. Obviously, when you start something, you want to see it continue forever. And that's kind of why I say I'm proudest of Xfire. I have a high degree of confidence that it will continue forever. And And yeah, so that was definitely, I would say, the number one criteria. And then all, everything else is satisfying stakeholders, external stakeholders, because that's really what your driving decisions are usually the people that you've brought on. You feel like a certain debt to them to helping you get as far as you've gotten, and you want to repay that debt.
So employee compensation, who was getting jobs after, how was the wealth going to be spread? How big was Xfire at the time of sale from an employee perspective?
We were like 35 employees. All the people loved being in gaming. There were very few online video game opportunities, startups in Silicon Valley. And so we attracted people who were deeply passionate about the space. And those were the people that got us through. Like when we were running out of cash, they took pay cuts. They took, you know, kind of, they worked harder. They got us through. They believed. They got us through the transition, and so those were the people ultimately that we felt the biggest obligation to.
Let's stick with Xfire for one more question, and then we'll move on. The best lesson you learned from dealing with the Viacom deal and selling Xfire for over $100 million?
Well, I really think you own your own destiny when you have multiple potential buyers and you have a go-alone strategy that can self-sustain. So, I mean, it wasn't really a big lesson there, because by the time we got to that sale, we were already in pretty good shape. But you need to be cultivating alternatives all the way along.
So cultivate alternatives all the way along, and the best time to be sold is when you don't have to.
Cliche almost, but it's true.
Well, take a step back. Before you were at Xfire, you were a venture capitalist north of the border, correct?
It was happy days.
Those were happy days when everyone was pitching you, and you invested in a lot of companies as a team. Cyberplex, Got Marketing, Think India, Border Free, Grocery Gateway, Zephyr. But the one I want to focus in right now is Direct Hit, which was sold to Ask Jeeves for $550 million. So what can you tell us about from the moment you met Direct Hit to the moment you got your check that was different than, say, on an Xfire deal when you were the entrepreneur?
Mike Cassidy was the CEO of Xfire, so I can't say enough good things, and the CEO of Direct Hit, I can't say enough good things about him. The moment you meet him, you feel like he's the guy who's going to get the job done. Direct Hit, the interesting thing was it was almost the opposite of Xfire in terms of when we were selling the business, we were extremely nervous about the future. The business was spending quite a bit of cash. The users were not staying, so we weren't basically making money on acquiring users. We were fighting against very well-capitalized competitors. The upstarts like Google had great technology, so there were other kind of startups with great technology. It was very nerve-wracking.
It's got to be interesting to think back of Google as a startup, but we'll get there in a second. Managing a portfolio is very different than having all your eggs in one basket. What's the difference you feel from a venture capitalist who's looking for M&A and an entrepreneur? For instance, they say that real estate agents always negotiate best on their own home because they're greatest affected by the price, whereas when they're negotiating for you, it's a few points here or there. Is the same true?
I think the motivations of the venture capitalists and the entrepreneurs are very different, and I think it's crucial that you understand that when you raise money from venture capitalists. So the biggest difference is, at least from my perspective, is that venture capitalists, what I would consider a decent return is almost just marginally better than a zero for most of them. Like getting three times their money is not why they invest. They invest to get 10, 20 times their money. And if they get three times their money, it's basically like getting their money back. And that is, when you look at their portfolio, that is because there's a very high correlation with the overall portfolio success with kind of the winners. And the ones where you make your money back don't really have that much impact. If you get an entrepreneur, you're very happy a lot of times with outcomes of three or four times the capital because you own a significant percent and you're getting, you know, a lot of many millions of dollars are going directly into your pocket.
So if there is a disparity between the alignment of interest between investors and entrepreneurs, but so many entrepreneurs do require venture capital investment to move forward. What recommendations can you make to manage that process?
Well, I think that the way that deals are structured with preferences actually is good, in the sense that, and just to take a step back, a lot of times venture capitalists will say, okay, I'll give you $3 or $4 million. If you sell the company for $20 million, I want my $3 or $4 million back, and then I want to participate as if I was converted and get my kind of return.
Yeah, liquidation preferences, yeah.
Exactly. So people call that double dipping. I actually think that is fair because it protects the – it starts to align incentives a little bit between the entrepreneur and the VC. And I think that on the extreme end, when you have a huge home run, there is good alignment and everybody's happy, obviously. And it's really in between where there's this misalignment, where you're selling kind of a sideways, what the VCs would consider kind of a for a nominal return. And I think that there's no real way to manage it. No one hoped to get into that situation. The VCs aren't going to invest in a business unless they think they're going to make it 20 times. And so when you're kind of trying to get a sale that's 3 or 4 times, I think what you're trying to basically convince the VCs of is things haven't worked out as you planned, but this is a lot better than kind of some of the alternatives.
So for our listeners who aren't aware, a liquidation preference is, as David had mentioned, it's an ability for them to get out first a certain amount and then to share pro rata. So in some cases they call it the double dip, but it really does come into play in only the middle ground. When you have a huge home run, either the liquidation preference isn't relevant or it fades away. But where it is this little return or a 3 times, 4 times return, you're saying that, David, that it kind of aligns interest in that you're making a shitload and the VC is making at least enough so that it won't negatively impact the portfolio, but it may actually give it a lift.
That's the way I think about it. I mean, I don't know if VCs are kind of happy in that outcome, but I always, as an entrepreneur, that's how I justify it to myself.
Well, that's good, because a lot of people do fight about liquidation preferences when instead of focusing on making sure they never come into play. When we come back from our break, we're going to talk to David about what's going on at Google, how best to work with Google, and how to get a big check from Google. And then, of course, we'll end with our 3 questions, the best advice David's ever received, the biggest mistake David's ever made, learned from it, as well as his advice to entrepreneurs in the audience. We'll be right back. You're listening to Wise Words, brought to you by the IBD Network. For the best of Silicon Valley, go to www.ibdnetwork.com.
Experience. It's the only thing that separates us from the animals. Well, that product placement.
And we're back. We're back with David Lally, currently a principal in the M&A group at Google, a serial entrepreneur in his own right, a proud Canadian, and a former reformed venture capitalist. Thanks for staying with us, Dave. We appreciate you sharing your knowledge.
My pleasure.
We're going to talk a little bit about building relationships with future acquirers. Now, you're currently with Google. Can you give us a little bit of an overview of sort of what you do there?
Yeah, I am one of the principals in the corporate development group, which means I span a broad set of our businesses and look for ways to accelerate things via acquisition. So I look for opportunities for us to acquire businesses where there is something Google is missing, either technology or people to execute or understanding of a particular market space.
Now, I was moderating an under-the-radar event, actually a DealMaker Forum event, where you brought some very serious wisdom to the table. One of the things that you and your fellow panelists from AOL and from Yahoo were talking about was a few things that entrepreneurs can do ahead of time to make sure they manage the process, one of which is find a champion. Can you tell us what that means and why it's important to have a champion inside of a future acquirer?
I think that you need to really understand the dynamics of the companies that you're talking to. Every company is completely different. It took me at least 3 months on the inside to understand Google. So you can assume from the outside that you're actually never going to understand it. And so you need to get as many points of reference as is possible so that you can have the best understanding. Is the person you're talking to someone who's respected or someone who is going to actually hurt your credibility internally? A lot of people actually don't figure that out, and they have the wrong person championing things internally, and that can be devastating.
So it's not only important to have a champion, but to have the right champion and check their internal credibility along the way. What externally can you do to check internal credibility?
if you have enough conversations with enough different people at the company acquirer, potential acquirer, then you usually, the truth usually surfaces. So you might not know who are the strong people and who are the weak people in your first conversations, or who are the people that are going to really take risk internally, which is what you need to champion, to be your champion, because usually it means they're putting their credibility on the line. So first they have to have credibility, then they have to be prepared to put it on the line. But you usually figure that, you usually get some sense for these things if you have a lot of conversations.
So let's stay with champion before we move on to the next lesson that we learned at the Dealmaker Forum. What's the best way to manage a champion relationship? For instance, in venture capital, at least north of the border, you always hear, I wouldn't invest in someone unless I have a beer with them. Meaning, I wouldn't invest in someone that I couldn't talk plainly with, I couldn't have a non-formal dialogue with, I couldn't be open with. Is the same true on a champion from an acquirer perspective, or is there a different way to manage the relationship?
The champion in the acquirer perspective might actually not be the person that you're going to spend the next 5 years working with, which is a little bit different than when you make an investment as a VC. The champion internally might just be the person who connects the dots for other people internally. So I would say it is definitely better if you have a personal relationship with the person that, you know, is kind of your chief advocate, because you'll have a better sense for how things are really materializing. There's a better likelihood they'll be honest with you. But I wouldn't say it's a lot of times it's not someone you're going to be working with long term. So the relationship, it's less important.
Now, one of the things that we learned was it's good to often walk before you run, which is another colloquialism for try to build a relationship. You mentioned in the X-Fire dialogue that Viacom was already a buyer of your advertising space, so they knew what you were capable of. They had a first-hand relationship dealing with you either directly or indirectly, but they saw how the technology works. What role does that sort of previous relationship play in acquisitions? Are some acquisitions right out of the blue, or are most dealt with on a relationship based when it comes to Google?
When I'm selling a deal internally, I am actually selling a deal. Like, if I believe that we should be acquiring something, I am going through the process internally of selling. There's definitely a lot of people who won't know about the company, and so I'm putting my neck on the line by kind of raising their profile, trying to highlight what I think are the kind of the key reasons to buy them, because it's a big hurdle, and making the case. So I think it's absolutely helpful to have had a previous relationship, because it means that when your champion is going out and internally selling, he's meeting up with more, or she's meeting up with more people who are already familiar with your story.
Absolutely. So we have find a champion, hopefully build a prior relationship. What other things can you recommend to those people who want to be bought by Google?
Well, I think beyond those things, there's really not that much you can do. You should stay in regular contact and keep kind of us abreast of the developments, because even though it seems like we would know of all the companies and what they're doing, it's very hard for us to keep track. So I would say be proactive in terms of reaching out and keeping us abreast and up to date.
Last question on Google before we move to the home stretch, if you will. What are you looking to buy next? We all know that you guys picked up Rightly. There's lots of rumors out there about you guys building an online office challenger. Where do you think you're going to be moving to next, if you can share us without getting in trouble with the SEC?
Yeah, I don't think I would be able to do that. I always am surprised, I guess, that now that I'm on the inside, that people don't see immediately why and the strategy behind some of the acquisitions. If you read through the transcripts of analyst days and read through our annual report, most of the acquisitions that we've done have been pretty consistent with the articulated strategy. So in the case of Rightly, there is this notion of making access to the files independent of your machine, and Rightly does that pretty nicely and allows you to collaborate and work with files that are basically maintained in the cloud, and that's a great thing. And it's a great thing for our users, it's a great thing for I think, development of the internet. And I think that's pretty consistent when you listen to kind of what was expressed. Similarly, with DMARC, we have talked about the advertising, the different forms of advertising as a key component to our growth strategy. And if you look at our print trials, we had things going in print advertising, and we had ideas about radio advertising. These weren't big leaps internally.
See, that's a very interesting point. I don't think many entrepreneurs would ever think to go to EDGAR, which is the online SEC database, and pull out quarterly and annual reports to read that or try to get transcripts. But you're recommending that the best way to know where large corporate behemoths are moving is to actually look at what's on their travel plans, what's on their map.
Yeah, I don't know if it's the best way, but it's definitely one way. And in most cases, I think pretty helpful.
And you've been really helpful, David. We're going to move into our home run. We always ask three questions here at Wise Words. They're similar but different, so if you can share with us the words of wisdom, we'll try not to put you on the spot too much. First and foremost, ever since you were a young man, you know, you come from a family of entrepreneurs. What was the best advice you got early on?
Take the money when you can get it. That's always the best advice.
Take the money when you get it. You're meaning when people offer you a deal, whether it's perfect or not, it's better to have the cookies when the cookies come around because you don't know when they're coming back?
I get it. That's it, exactly. Most of the time, it just staying in the game is three-quarters of the challenge, and capitalization is kind of the main thing you have to worry about as an entrepreneur. So if you can get capital under reasonable terms, don't quibble. Get it quickly. Drive ahead.
Okay, question number two, and our three questions we ask all of our guests. Your personal biggest mistake and what you've learned from it and what we can learn from it.
I personally have made the same mistake repeatedly, so I don't know if I've learned from it, but it's very hard to figure out when to exit. And sometimes you think that there are more good times ahead. Other times you are kind of less confident. Usually things work out differently than you kind of predict on both sides. So with Xfire, if you had said, okay, I'll give you $25 million, 2 years ago, I would have been like, oh my God, thank God. And who would have really thought that we would have made it as far? Similarly, there have been, opposite stories where I thought things were going to the moon and it didn't work out that way.
Now, you say you made that mistake many times, but not everyone would argue with a $100 million exit as an entrepreneur and an exit.
I was really lucky to have great partners, yeah.
Okay.
Great partner. It really makes a huge difference. Like, you have to surround yourself with people who have different opinions so that you can have those debates and you can come out with hopefully the best answer. And chances are it's going to take, someone who's more aggressive to kind of, and someone who's, a little bit more cautious, and the mix between those two is usually better than one person's thought.
The yin and yang of entrepreneurship.
Almost every great company has been started by a pair, and I think there's a reason.
It's interesting. We've just published an article in the Globe and Mail on choosing your partner. Is starting a family similar to starting a business, and why it's so important to have the right partner? So that's a good tie-in. I appreciate the plug, even if it was inadvertent. Second last question for you. Going forward, now that you have all of these credentials behind you, I'm sure lots of people are asking for your advice. What's the best advice you can give?
Well, there's only two things that I kind of go back to. It's the tenacity and the luck, one you can control and one you can't control. So you just have to be tenacious. People come in here all the time. They say, what do you think about this idea? I'm like, I don't know. Maybe it could work. Maybe it won't. But if you don't try and if you don't really push, it definitely won't. And so, yeah, you've got to get up there and, take your shots.
David, final question. Happy as an entrepreneur, happy as a VC, happy in big corporate life. Which has been the best times of your life?
I think I'm in it. Honestly, people ask me, do you like your job? I say, I've never been happier, and I also don't know if I'll be as happy in 18 months. Like, I think right now, it's I'm at Google. It's the greatest company in history, potentially, and maybe in its greatest time in history. Hopefully not. But definitely I'm enjoying myself right now.
Well, I hope the good times are only starting and that it continues to grow for you at Google. If not for you, then for your options. We've been talking to David Lally. Thanks so much for sitting with us today.
Thank you.
And when we come back, we'll wrap up. Thanks very much to David Lally, currently principal in the M&A group of Google.
Silence! Fool chatters! But the wise man listens.
And that wraps up another interview and another podcast. You've been listening to the Wise Words podcast, brought to you by the fine folks at IBD Network. For the best of Silicon Valley, go to www.ibdnetwork.com. Tune in next week for more best practices, insights, and interviews on entrepreneurship, finance, and technology. Till then, I'm your host, Sean Wise. You can reach me at www.seanwise.com. Thank you, and good venturing.